we felt that there was an opportunity to launch a consumer product that captured medical grade information and to use that channel to aggregate first of its kind data and to leverage that data to develop novel screening and diagnostic tools. The biggest problem in obstetrics today is preterm birth. That's sort of the biggie. And we felt that by having better data that more comprehensively assessed maternal and fetal health longitudinally throughout pregnancy and doing this over tens of thousands of pregnancies, we could develop better risk stratification models and you could tackle what is a complex disease with many etiologies and really truly tailor care.
And now from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Our guest today is Aaron Parks, a clinical psychologist, researcher, and former director at the UC San Diego Eating Disorder Center. Aaron is currently the chief clinical officer and co-founder of Equip, a telehealth platform for eating disorder treatment. In this episode, Aaron covers the basics of data-driven eating disorder treatment and barriers to access. She advocates for family-based treatment, an approach that involves a patient's entire support system and prioritizes their lived experience. Here's our conversation. Welcome, Eric. Thanks for joining me this morning. And it's kind of afternoon where you are.
That's right. Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you here today and for you to share with us your story and your journey. And maybe you can start by you telling us about your background. You did study biomedical engineering. It's a kind of engineering and medical at the same time. Do you always know that you're always interested in the medical healthcare field? I mean, how did you end up doing biomedical engineering?
Yeah. So honestly, I did actually always know I was going to get into the healthcare field. Both my parents work in healthcare. So my dad was a general surgeon. My mom was an ER nurse. And so I've always grown up in a healthcare household. All I've ever known is healthcare. I originally was planning on going and studying to be a doctor. But my dad actually talked me out of it and suggested I do something else besides go and be a doctor.
Why? I mean, he's a surgeon. Yeah, he does not want you to be one. What did he learn that he doesn't want the son to have?
Yeah, you know, I think at the time he was just having a lot of general frustration with you know, some of the politics of the US hospital he was working at. I think some of the rising malpractice rates at the time, you know, in like the mid to late 90s, and just maybe was feeling at the moment of his career perhaps a little disillusioned with the space. That being said, it didn't really stop me from going and studying bioengineering and eventually biomedical engineering. And I still became a doctor, just not a medical doctor. I went and got a PhD. I always figured I would work in something in healthcare. It's really the only thing I ever knew. So that's kind of where my interest gravitated towards.
I mean, did you always like hang out in the hospital? I mean, I can't imagine bringing kids to work all the time though.
Well, you know, the funny thing is like, yes, I kind of did. We would go visit my mom at night in the ER and we just like walk into the ER or like, you know, God knows how many times I broke things and needed stitches and we just would go to the hospital and just walk in and someone would like fix something. And it never really dawned on me that that's not what other people's experience is like until afterwards, you know, and actually like not at in my hometown and having to go get medical procedure and having to wait so long, but it never dawned on me that people just don't walk right in and go see a doctor and get treated right away. So I spent a lot of time in the hospital and even spent some time at one summer, I think this was probably sometime in college, shadowing my dad in surgery. And I actually did have an incident where we were in a surgery and I almost passed out from sort of seeing what was going on. I was definitely getting woozy and the nurses are like, he's going down. And they pulled me out and gave me some orange juice or something. So yeah, I've grown up in a lot of medical environments.
Yet after that experience, you still wanted to become a doctor until your dad kind of...
Yeah, I think at that point then I was perhaps reconsidering the surgery route and perhaps something that was a little less, I don't know.
Bloody.
Yeah, exactly.
That's interesting. It's so funny because I found that kids who grew up with doctor's parents, either they want to become a doctor or they do not want to do anything in that space at all. So it's, you know, it's interesting that, you know, many of my doctor's friends' children, they tend to stay away from mm-hmm. their parents' field. But you're one of the few that I know who's like, okay, I really want to be.
Yeah. And, you know, you grew up in I mean, my dad worked insane hours. He was starting his private practice. And so he was always working. And I suppose, you know, one might see that and say, okay, well, that's, you know, that's not for me. Of course, then I go and do something stupid like starting a company, which means pretty much I'm just working all the time. So,
right.
So somehow I ended up, you know, back where I was maybe perhaps trying to avoid at one point, but you know.
Well, that's good. So you got your biomedical engineering degree and then you decide to go PhD route somehow is because you just want to be in school for a lot longer.
Yeah, well, I did an undergrad at Cornell and was graduating in 2002, and so the economy wasn't in such a great situation at that time, and I didn't really find many things I wanted to do with sort of just a bachelor's, and so I was just going to go do a master's degree, and there was a professor I was working with at Cornell that moved out to UCLA that, you know, gave me a scholarship to go get a PhD. And I was like, all right, well, you know, that sounds like not a bad idea. Go hang out. And I don't think I fully had realized what I was jumping into. And so eventually got, you know, was there and, you know, about 3 or 4 years into the PhD and realizing I better really like buckle down and focus. You're never going to get out of this program. And so I ended up, yeah, getting a PhD at UCLA, looking at MEMS devices applied into, you know, medical applications. And then graduated in 2008 when, again, the economy was not in such a great position. And so ended up working with a researcher at UCLA and then was a senior scientist at a organization in Belgium called IMEC, mm-hmm. which was really a very fascinating place, one of the world leaders in innovation in nanoelectronics and nanotechnology. And so I ended up doing a postdoc there, knowing full well I needed to get out of research as like my core area of focus and eventually talk my way into a business development job. And that's
within the IMEC.
Exactly. And that's where I started sort of transitioning more towards business side of medical and science.
What triggered you to say, like, I want to be on the business side rather than stay on the research?
I love science and technology. Like I could spend all of my days just like reading about it and researching the products and the businesses, but I have never been a particularly good researcher. I'm too impatient. I didn't really know what business development was until I saw a job posting and it sounded great. And so, ended up going and interviewing, for this role and kind of talking them into hiring me since I had no experience whatsoever, and found it was great. I mean, I get a chance to go out and meet companies solving interesting problems and think through the kind of technologies that would be necessary to solve those kind of problems and then be essentially the interface between scientists and the researchers that are doing the work and the businesses that are actually have problems to solve and try to pair people up and sort of help quarterback it in a way how these solutions might come together and of course let things kind of turn them over to the actual technical teams for development. And it was just sort of a perfect marriage of my passion for science and technology and the fact that I'm more of an extrovert and being, you know, in front of a computer the whole time and sort of on my own is just not really where how I like to live my life. So mm-hmm. that's kind of how I got transitioned.
Tell me a bit more about IMEC. What were they trying to do in Belgium? And what is it like innovation environment in Europe?
Yeah, so IMEC, so it's a advanced research center located in Belgium, a very unlikely place for the kind of research that they do. It's about, right now it's probably about 40 years old, and it started off, they started off really being one of the centers for the semiconductor industry to bring the full sort of value chain together to de-risk the next generation transistor nodes. So, you know, Moore's law, you know, has dictated that the size of transistors essentially is going to, the density of transistors is essentially going to double every 18 months. And at one point, this was all being done independently by all these different companies. And at a certain point, the cost of developing the next generation transistor was getting so high that it didn't make sense for anyone to do it on their own. They had to kind of come together. And so this became a place where people could come together, including competitors, to do pre-competitive research together to de-risk the next technology. And then they would sort of share in the cost, share in the risk, and then they would each kind of take their work and bring it back into their internal companies and then further commercialize it. And so they ended up developing over the course of 30 years, this, you know, massive $1 billion plus clean room infrastructure for developing, you know, transistors. And as you know, there's a lot of things that have spawned from the semiconductor industry besides making computer chips smaller and faster. And so there was a number of different application areas that they developed technologies in, all based around semiconductor-based manufacturing, from you know, solar and next gen sort of energy, you know, ultra low power analog chips, next gen wireless. And then there was a large area of work. At the time it was small, and now it's grown to be a pretty large area of work in healthcare. Mm-hmm. And that was thinking about everything from point of care diagnostics, next gen sequencing, and all the way through the mobile health and wearable space. And so I joined that company working in their healthcare business line, originally as a researcher working on implantable devices, and eventually, as mentioned, sort of transitioning to a business development role. But it's a very interesting place. I think it has probably now about 3,000 people that work there, some of the top scientists and researchers, certainly in Europe, if not the world. And so these companies, they essentially will send their own researchers to go work at IMEC for three, four-year period stints with IMEC researchers and collaborate on projects and then, you know, bring them to market. It's a very fascinating place. It's probably one of the most innovative, you know, research centers globally. And they do what they consider to be sort of in between academic research and industry research. So they kind of close that gap.
It's interesting because many people, when they think about innovation, they always think about Silicon Valley or like in the healthcare, the Bay Area or United States. Most people don't think about Europe to be the center of that kind of activity. Obviously, that center has been there for a long time. I guess I was not aware of that, even though I did live in Europe before.
Yeah, I mean, there's. I think certainly the U.S. is known for a lot more of the innovation, but I think that's probably because a lot more we're better at commercializing things, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of Silicon Valley, of course, has like Stanford and Berkeley and. You know, but it's really as much as those are obviously incredibly famous schools, it's really those schools that have led to breakthrough businesses is why I think Silicon Valley is as well known as it is. Mm-hmm. Europe has some amazing research centers, IMEC being one of them. I mean, EPFL, I mean, there's, you know, places in the UK that are just great at research, but I don't think they've had as much of a focus on the commercialization side. Mm-hmm. And IMEC is one of the few, and I've gotten increasingly good at actually turning their research into commercial products. But, you know, they're not, they essentially license things out. So it's almost like the Intel Inside kind of thing is like, they should have done some branding of like IMEC Inside, because IMEC essentially has enabled the semiconductor industry to enable Moore's Law for the past 30 years. So mm-hmm. much of the innovation that you see today and all of the computers we're using is actually coming from IMEC. And then most people don't know that.
It's interesting. Oftentimes when you're so focused on the science part, often the science people tend to not think about the branding and the marketing. And then they're losing out, at least for recognition purposes, but maybe they don't care. But I think sometimes when you create the branding, it makes your next generation job easier.
It's very true. I feel like most scientists and researchers aren't great at branding themselves. I guess, to a certain extent, I have that DNA because I hate self-promotion. Like, I'm just terrible at it. I don't like posting anything about me.
Yeah.
Things. I just don't like it.
It seems scary to me, at least for me. I'm just like, oh, nobody needs to know everything about what I think. That's
why. Yeah, I'm happy to share my opinion in like this kind of setting. I don't know. It seems, I always find the things, it feels boastful. And so I'm a bit more of a modest person, I think, in general.
This podcast is sponsored by Brown Rudnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that help life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownrudnick.com. This podcast is also sponsored by Canon Quality Group. Canon Quality Group has been helping med tech startups set up quality management systems for over 10 years. If you're unsure when to get started with quality management in your startup, turn to the experts at canonqualitygroup.com.
So you were in IMEC in Europe and probably have comfortable career and life. And then you make the jump to do some, you know, startup, which, you know, like what you're saying, you work a lot of hours. And what make you decide to do that jump?
So I've always been interested in entrepreneurship. Before starting Bloom Life, there was a neural implant company that I helped get off the ground. Not so dissimilar to what Elon Musk's company is doing now with those implantable sort of probes to sort of interface with the brain. So there was a European funded project that had some pretty innovative things in terms of how to, like, you know, make these implantables with higher density of electrodes for various medical applications. And so, in any case, I always knew I wanted to start a company. And I guess where I was at the time was, IMEC, within the healthcare domain, the area that they were probably most well known for was all of their work in wearable technologies. There they were really pioneering some very interesting technologies, primarily because they had advantages on the silicon level. So they actually had proprietary chips that enabled them to unlock higher like applications or devices that you weren't really possible with off the shelf chips. And so they had all these really interesting prototype products that we were trying to go and license to like large companies, because those are the ones that could typically afford to work with IMEC. The only problem was most large companies were like, what the hell's a wearable device? Why would I care about a wearable device? And so IMEC was just ahead of the market, especially where the large companies were. And so we were having just challenges trying to, you know, find businesses that were sort of interested in the technologies. And then once we did find businesses, it was like, without going into the details, there was always a lot of struggle to like get full buy-in from the IMEC people to like work with these companies. And so eventually, I said, why do this for someone else when I could just do it for myself? I have enough belief and confidence in where this space is going. And I ended up finding a partner at IMEC, my co-founder, Julian Penders, who was essentially my partner in arms going around the world trying to license these technologies out. And we, you know, just had similar energy, similar personalities, similar passion for the space, and decided that we would start a company in the consumer health kind of wearable world. Back in 2012, 2013 is when we decided we wanted to do something. And then we spent about a year and a half just kind of like thinking through some of the, you know, themes that we thought were really exciting and interesting to build a business around. And that's kind of how we got started.
So what's your process at that time? Were you like, just like, okay, I'm going to just landscape areas that have a good market opportunity and then look for technology to help solve that? Or you have the technology that you're interested in developing and to bring it to the market?
So,
else?
So the things that we saw was that I was going around and licensing a particular technology that we had developed to like a consumer electronic company, right? Like a Fitbit at the time, Under Armour, or Samsung, like companies that were making just consumer health products, you know. And, you know, the next week, you know, we were going out and licensed the exact same technology to a medical device company. And it sort of dawned on us that at a technology level, there's nothing different between a consumer product and a medical device. The only difference is sort of the, you know, the development process you put around it, the application going after, the regulatory requirements. But the idea that a consumer product could be a medical device and therefore a consumer product can collect medical grade data was kind of just an interesting kind of insight that we had. And we felt that these two markets were going to be converging and that that would essentially really help accelerate medical discovery and innovation, especially in areas that have been largely under-researched or understudied or where capturing data sets was typically really hard. And so that was kind of like one sort of big insight that we had. And so with that, through that lens, we started thinking about, you know, therapeutic areas where better data could really drive a big breakthrough, whether or not that was improvement in screening, diagnosis, improved management of treatment. And so, you know, we looked at a couple different areas, everything from like neurodegenerative diseases to sort of cardiovascular, and ended up settling in the maternal health space because we were trying to find areas where there was this desire from a patient to almost be like a consumer. Like as a consumer, I want more information. Right. And where you could leverage that desire for more information to provide a product that served their needs and sort of at the same time was aggregating data that could serve medical purposes. And so there's probably no one in the world from a patient perspective that's more interested about what's happening with their body than a pregnant mom. And as we started spending more time looking into the literature and talking with talking to OBGYNs around, you know, what are the challenges they face today and you know, it's just an area that has lacked innovation in decades and that has been largely understudied, you know, I mean, even at the sort of the federal level of funding. And we felt that there was just a very kind of unique opportunity here to try to innovate.
Yeah. Would you mind, I think that's, thanks for sharing that your thinking behind starting the Bloom Life. Maybe you could tell us what is Bloom Life trying to address?
Sure. So Bloom Life, we are a women's health company that is looking to solve some of the largest unaddressed challenges in maternal health. We have been developing remote prenatal care solutions, a part of which is a device that we've developed that allows us to, it's a small patch, it's one in the belly, and allows us to track non-invasively various physiological signals of maternal fetal health. These include parameters that are used in clinical practice today, such as fetal heart rate and uterine activity, as well as health parameters that have been shown in medical literature to impact birth outcomes, such as maternal stress. And the whole idea is to think about how we might deliver prenatal care in a different way that improves access to care, helps to provide reassurance and empower moms to take a more active role in managing her care, and aggregates data to help clinicians earlier predict and manage pregnancy complications. So yeah, that's kind of what we're building.
So where are you at now? I mean, the product's in the market and have helped many women, and being in a consumer and devices, like, you know, some people just like, well, you know, consumer is so expensive to go directly to the consumer, but then there's also so many different opportunities that, you know, some people like just to go to direct to consumer as well. What are the challenges and what are the pro and the con, I guess, going towards the route of the consumer?
So our vision has been to kind of follow in many ways what 23andMe has done in genomics. We felt that there was an opportunity to launch a consumer product that captured medical grade information and to use that channel to aggregate first of its kind data and to leverage that data to develop novel screening and diagnostic tools. The biggest problem in obstetrics today is preterm birth. That's sort of the biggie. And we felt that by having better data that more comprehensively assessed maternal and fetal health longitudinally throughout pregnancy and doing this over tens of thousands of pregnancies, we could develop better risk stratification models and you could tackle what is a complex disease with many etiologies and really truly tailor care. So if you had a better assessment of comprehensively all the risk a mom has, you could really start to focus incrementally on addressing one risk factor at a time, or at least focusing on the ones that were the greatest contributing factor to likelihood of delivering preterm and then lower her risk for a mom that might have a 30% chance of delivering preterm? Can I move her to like 20% chance? Or take a mom from 20% chance and move her to 10%? And so that was kind of the big idea. But that implies though that over the long term, deploying into healthcare is required, and that has always been our North Star. That being said, as you pointed out, we started off in the consumer world, and so the first product we launched was a consumer device. It was a device to allow mom to track and time her contractions. Kind of very simple concept, but one that we found that oftentimes women weren't really sure whether or not she was having contractions, weren't really sure about timing those, especially if a mom, might be having preterm contractions. They're not as strong as like true labor contractions, so there's just a lot of stress and uncertainty that led to unnecessary trips. And later we added on maternal stress as another feature. One of the things we were always trying to do was kind of like start the consumer side and then behind the scenes kind of like build the data set, do the research, get the medical side going. And, one of the things we learned is that is really, really, really hard to do at the same time. You just can't really. I mean, the demands are too different. Our consumer product was successful to the extent that we have aggregated now the largest physiological data set in the world. We successfully did a round of biomarker discovery and identified a combination of physiological features that allow us to identify labor onset, validated that in a prospective study that was funded by the European Commission, but then got to a point where we just couldn't support the consumer medical product concurrently. And we had to decide which one we want to do, consumer or medical. And because, getting these things truly deployed at scale requires support from providers, we decided to focus on that exclusively. And so that's really been our focus since really the beginning of 2020.
Mm-hmm. So that's a big change. Do you think had Loom Life has a bigger, if you're within a larger corporation, you might be able to do both, or you just have, because of the nature of being a startup, which allow you to be nimble, but then also you're constrained with the number of resources that you have.
I think with a lot more resources, you could do both.
An advantage to do both as well?
There's a big advantage to being able to do both. The rate at which we were able to aggregate data was pretty astounding. I mean, we had close to 15,000 users over about 18 months that we were able to aggregate data from and generate almost 1 million hours of longitudinal data. The next largest data set that we've seen is about just under 500 people that took about 6 years to collect. Mm-hmm. And the reason we were able to collect it is somewhat different is because we're not doing this under necessarily like this expensive, time-consuming clinical trial where you're asking people to come into the doctor's office a few times a week. It doesn't work. And so the whole point of consumer health products, you could actually put them in people's homes, they can wear them in their real life, they can put them on whatever you want. And that I think is a critical component. But yeah, I mean, as you know, the quality systems you need for developing a consumer product, the speed at which you could iterate on a consumer product versus a medical device is just very different. But to reach the scale, I think to one of your earlier questions, you need to have providers supporting you, right? Especially in this area, you need to have payer coverage, especially if you want to get to underserved communities that aren't going to be able to afford to buy out of pocket for a consumer product. And that has been a core part of our mission. And so we had to make difficult decisions, and here we are.
And it's definitely a long journey, but when it works, I think the fact that it can affect a lot more people, I think that would be a rewarding one.
Yeah.
So before we end, I want to get your thought about, you've been doing the Bloom Life, bring it to the consumer, managed to get a lot of traction there. And now you're trying to focus on getting more on the medical side. What are the lessons learned, including your experience at IMEC, what are the lessons learned, what to do and what not to do? Because the, learning what not to do is sometimes stickier in your brain too.
So lessons learned. Pay for talent. Pay for senior talent. That oftentimes at an early stage, you think you have to try to. There's always this balance between managing burn and just like paying to get things done. And I think bringing on, talent people, even if you have to pay a lot more for them, is typically going to pay off. assume that everything's going to take twice as long and twice as much money as what you've ever, you know, initially planned, and figuring out how that sort of fits into your overall strategy, I think is important. Get in front of users and be in front of users all the time. Always be talking to your customers. You know, that's, I mean, these are things I think that are everyone knows these things, but sometimes it's easy to not do them. And inevitably, you have a better chance of having a successful product if you're constantly talking to people and your users and getting their feedback. And don't be afraid to go, you know, seek out answers from people that are a lot smarter than you and done these things before. Some of, you know, it's like in a startup, your pace is so critical. And if there's someone out there that might be able to accelerate your learning by several months, you need to go find that person. And this is, I guess, a shout out to the Roseman Institute here, because you guys have done an amazing job of actually bringing together these ecosystems of experts. And I know I've turned more than once to a number of folks that I've met through your organization that have really helped accelerate a lot of our learning in some pretty important ways.
I think that's I'm a big believer, like learn from others who has gone through it the hard way. And you can learn it from an hour conversation rather than live through it. It makes a huge difference.
Yeah. Yeah. The only problem is you also need to be receptive to what you hear. And as someone who's definitely, who's advised a few companies, you know, all you can do is share a perspective, and then they have to do with it what they want to do. And so
right.
I've definitely tried to take to heart what people say, you know, process it and translate it for what it means for us, and then be able to action as many of the insights as I've been able to capture.
That's well said. I think I always say, you know, get the information. At the end of the day, you have to just analyze it and then make it work with your own situation, because no situation is exactly the same as what you have. So at the end of the day, you still have to make that decision on what path and, you know, to the left or to the right. And
yep,
so
that's right.
Good. So, but yeah, take all, I was telling my son, is like, you know, take all the feedback, you know, take the data. It's just like you're collecting data. At the end of the day, you decide what to do with that data. But if you don't ask feedback, nobody gives you the data, then you don't have anything to analyze with.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. True.
Well, that's great. That's great advice. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Enjoy the rest of your time in East Coast before you come back to the Bay Area.
Thanks, Christine. It was great talking with you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Health Technology Podcast. We want to thank our executive producer, Herminio Neto, our content writer, Kelly Muscat, and our podcast engineer, Andrew Rojek. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to subscribe and leave a review. The Health Technology Podcast is available on all major platforms.